Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald. The authorities in Hong Kong have made some moves in anticipation of another weekend of protests. The police arrested and then released prominent activists today. They also rejected plans for a march on Saturday. Let's discuss why this weekend in particular gives the Hong Kong authorities the jitters. With me is Justin Si, an expert on the social movements of the Cantonese speakers in China and the diaspora. He's the lead author of the book, lead editor of the book, Theological Reflections on the Hong Kong Umbrella Movement. Thanks for joining us, Justin.
Hi, Jerome.
I wonder if you could explain. This Saturday is the anniversary of a decision by the Chinese legislature to impose limitations on elections in Hong Kong, the moment that kicked off the umbrella movement 5 years ago. Can you explain why this is meaningful?
Yeah, I think this is meaningful because in 2014, there were some reinterpretations of the system by which Hong Kong exists in relation to the mainland. It's called One Country, Two Systems, and it's enshrined in a mini constitution called Basic Law. And what it guarantees is that Hong Kong will have universal suffrage, among other things, but that Hong Kong will also have a high degree of autonomy from the mainland. The reinterpretation in 2014, both in June and August, held that Hong Kong was under Chinese sovereignty and therefore would be subjected in some ways to the to decisions made on the mainland. And when that happened, I remember one speech that the now incarcerated social movement organizer Benny Tai, who organized Occupy Central, he gave in front of, I think it was Government House. He said that the city is burning and that our house is on fire and that there was little that could be done about it. Because he said that there was little that could be done about it, students were upset about that and held student strikes. And collectively, they decided to occupy a central city, a central urban square in the District of Admiralty called Civic Square. And because of police brutality, tens of thousands of people gathered on the streets with umbrellas to ward off tear gas, and that was what the umbrella movement was in 2014. So it's quite a significant anniversary, I would say.
And why does it resonate with all the people who've been in the streets here lately? Is there a direct correlation between what's happening now and that moment?
You know, I think if you listen to people on the streets in Hong Kong, what you hear is that they talk about learning the lessons of the umbrella movement. And what they mean by that is that there were some mistakes that they deemed themselves to have made in 2014. They thought of themselves as very divided in 2014, that they wanted to be a leaderless movement, but whenever there was somebody who had a good idea, that they would get shot down. Because of that divisiveness, they felt that that movement failed. This time, they have slogans that say that, you know, we need to be united. And therefore, even though there's dissent, what they try to do is they try to seek some kind of consensus and to leave no people behind. You see all these young people who are protesting, and even if they disagree with the decisions of their peers, they leave no one behind, even though they might think that somebody is doing something stupid. So there's some, I wouldn't say nostalgia for the umbrella movement, but there's a certain memory of the umbrella movement in which they say, well, you know, we don't want to make the mistakes of 2014. We want to have a social movement that works.
Now, the people that the Hong Kong authorities arrested today, Joshua Wong, some others, they are not exactly calling the shots here in this new movement. What does arresting them do?
You know, I really think that, I mean, social media has been all abuzz by this. And the mantra of this movement has been that it is leaderless. And here I have to sort of give a sort of disclaimer for what it means for me to go on the radio with you as well. I am not trying to represent any movement or any protesters. And I'm not representing anyone because again, that would defy sort of the spirit of what's going on here. I think there seems to be, though, this sort of need for the authorities to identify what in Cantonese is called a black hand behind the protest, somebody who's manipulating behind the scenes. Another word, just to contrast the black hand, is they use the word white terror to describe the sort of climate of fear that has been that the authorities are trying to spread to dissuade people from going to protest and to appear in any sort of public capacity. So I think that there is a sort of deliberate misreading calculated to sort of create perhaps a climate of fear. And the responses that I've seen so far is that they're kind of trying to call the authorities bluff.
I'm talking with Justin See. He's lead editor of the book Theological Reflections on the Hong Kong Umbrella Movement, and we're talking about some of the moves that the Hong Kong authorities have made in anticipation of this weekend's protest. They arrested some prominent activists today. There's also been some military movements. There is a garrison that is having a troop rotation right now, and it looks kind of intimidating. What is that all about?
You know, I think there's a lot of speculation about what the military north of Hong Kong might or might not be doing. Certainly, we've seen videos of military exercises, and as you say, the rotation in the garrison. Some people point out, well, look, the presence of militarized police and also the sort of tactics that have been used in the past few weeks are sort of indications that those military tactics are being experimented on, you might say, in Hong Kong already. But the major point, I think, is that the people who are on the streets are basically trying to say that Hong Kong is their home. And if you think about this in terms of global social movements, so not particular to Hong Kong, it's almost sort of like the way that Black Lives Matter might protest police terrorism, or the Maidan in Ukraine in 2014 was about police brutality. These are not really quote unquote political ideological stances. They're basically saying, I have a home, you're taking it away from me with violence, and I don't want violence in my home, which is not much of an ideology.
Yeah, it people don't think about that enough, that is a highly motivating thing among some of the resistance that we see out there. They want nonviolence.
That's right. So I think there's been a lot of focus on the way that the protests have quote unquote turned violent, or that there has been violence towards property. But I think, you know, if you read the five demands that the protesters have in Hong Kong towards the Hong Kong government, they're basically saying that they don't want violence in their home and that they would like to live peaceable everyday lives.
One of the things that the protesters wanted to see was the withdrawal of this extradition bill. And Reuters has an article today that says that Carrie Lam thought, well, okay, I earlier this summer thought she would withdraw the bill. She would do this thing that she has been unwilling to do. But that the Chinese authorities, the Beijing authorities, they said no. They said, we are not going to allow you to withdraw this bill, and she was not allowed to withdraw the bill because it seems like an easy thing to do. That's an easy demand to get. If you're not going to pass it anyway, why not withdraw it?
This was the subject of a number of press conferences as well. Numerous journalists asked her, well, if you're going to suspend the bill, which is what she said that she was going to do, why not just withdraw it altogether? Because suspension simply means that when the protests are over, it can be it doesn't even have to be reintroduced. It just needs to be brought back to life, as it were. So this explains a number of the the language that she used during those press conferences. She said, "Don't debate about semantics. It's dead like a cockroach," she says. And people listening to these press conferences would say, "No, the semantics actually matter quite a bit." The larger insight here is that, you know, if Hong Kong exists, it's supposed to exist in a high degree of autonomy in a one country, two systems framework with the mainland. If the chief executive of Hong Kong is beholden to other authorities, well, then the meaning of high degree of autonomy is up for debate. And so, so I think basically what is being talked about in Hong Kong is actually this legal arrangement. And in some ways, if you really think about it, it has to do with the question of rule of law. What does it mean to have enshrined in the law that the territory has a high degree of autonomy? And yet in practice, these semantics are debated.
I wanted to ask a question about, you know, you were talking about nonviolence in the protests and the demand, the kind of universal demand for nonviolence. I was thinking of another thing that was kind of universal in protests around the world that may or may not be applicable in Hong Kong, but inequality. Is inequality and economic exploitation a serious factor here?
It certainly is a factor. Now, this has been sort of the government party line that if only the people on the street were satiated in terms of their housing needs. Hong Kong is a very expensive city. There is the phenomenon of what are called cage houses and subdivided rooms in which people rent a fraction of a small apartment or rent apartments with iron bars as doors. If it were easier for people to start businesses because it's very difficult, then perhaps the people's demands would go away. I think that there is perhaps some legitimacy to this, but what it runs the risk of is, in the words of one of my theologian colleagues in Hong Kong, Gong Lapyan, what it does is it reduces a political movement to a social movement. And what that means is that it reduces some the awakening of a sort of political consciousness that people are beginning to think, I am a Hong Konger, I am from Hong Kong, Hong Kong is my home. It reduces that to issues of housing and class and economics. And I sort of want to resist that sort of reduction, even though that there are underlying economic factors as well.
But so the democracy demands seem to be more upfront than the inequality demands.
I think even more upfront. So the democracy demands were more upfront, especially during the Umbrella Movement. That's certainly still part of the five demands. But even more than that is the demand for Hong Kong as a home to be respected, and the way for that to happen is to have a government that is seen as legitimate by its residents.
The authorities just seem more and more impatient with the protests, and the protests are, you know, there have been some gigantic ones recently.
That's right.
What's the rub here? I mean, how do we square this circle? And if nobody's going to stand down, what happens?
You know, this is one of those moments where I say, I cannot predict the future. I was saying earlier to some friends that even now the news is moving very quickly. Because, you know, we're hearing about these arrests today. It seems to be one thing after another. It seems to me that at issue are the five demands by the protesters. And it seems to me that the five demands are being addressed either obliquely or not addressed at all by the government. If this situation does not change, I sort of feel like it's going to be a vicious cycle. One of the interesting things that's happening, if one pays attention to the lives of students, is that school is starting now. So there's that added dimension too, to that that may sort of change the events a little bit.
Well,
there's also an election coming up.
There's an election coming.
There's an election coming up, and so there might be some sort of some people might say, well, stop protesting, start getting involved in local district politics. I've already seen that on social media. Some people are calling for that. People are debating them. So I think there are those two things that may that may change things, you know, later towards this year.
Thanks a lot for joining us, Justin C. Lee, editor of the book Theological Reflections on the Hong Kong Umbrella Movement. Thanks for joining us and talking about the upcoming protests this week in Hong Kong and in the coming weeks.
Thanks, Jerome.
Coming up after the break, we'll talk about the climate strike. The 16-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg has called for a general strike to coincide with the UN Climate Action Conference. Coming up after the break, we'll find out how architects are answering the call. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg brings a new urgency to the climate crisis. She started her school strikes alone, but now has motivated millions of people to demand action. Here she is earlier this year at Davos.
The main solution, however, is so simple that even a small child can understand it. We have to stop the emissions of greenhouse gases. And either we do that or we don't. You say nothing in life is black or white, but that is a lie, a very dangerous lie. Either we prevent a 1.5 degree of warming or we don't. Either we avoid setting off that irreversible chain reaction beyond human control or we don't. Either we choose to go on as a civilization or we don't. That is as black or white as it gets. We must change almost everything in our current societies. The bigger your carbon footprint is, the bigger your moral duty. The bigger your platform, the bigger your responsibility. Adults keep saying, we owe it to the young people to give them hope. But I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then I want you to act. I want you to act as if you would in a crisis. I want you to act as if the house was on fire. Because it is.
That Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg at Davos earlier this year. Greta's carbon-free transatlantic trip to the UN Climate Action Conference has garnered a lot of attention in the press. It's up for grabs, though, whether the people in the U.S. will respond to her call for a general strike. The school strikers in Chicago are asking people to join them for a general strike on September 20th. I Googled around the other day to see what civil society organizations are responding to the call for a general strike, and one of them is architects. With me is Thomas Jacobs. He's co-founder of Architects Advocate for Action on Climate Change. He's a partner at Crick and Sexton Architects. Thanks a lot for joining us, Thomas.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about our Architects Advocate for Action on Climate Change. I did not know this existed.
Yes, we started about in the late summer of 2016. This was the moment building up to the presidential election, where only two candidates were remaining, and one of them made the statement that climate change was a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese, and this was the moment where my head exploded. As somebody who's always cared about this issue, I also grew up in the natural environment in Switzerland. We were hiking every weekend. We spent our days in nature. So this was a moment where I was actually almost more shocked by the lack of the reaction. You know, the statement was...
There was no debate about climate in the debates. There was, you know, the only question was from the coal industry, and people were more concerned with his red sweater than climate change. It was a very weird scene.
Exactly. And I just remember that I thought, as an architect in particular, I mean, this was a full frontal assault on scientific consensus, the things we know work. And I thought it was very strange that there was no reaction. There's almost sort of this deafening silence moment. And so we thought we should try it, especially architects. You know, we are responsible for creating the built environment, which contributes 40% of greenhouse gas emissions or carbon emissions. And so we really are in control of making real change that can turn this around. And so we launched the platform.
Now, how did you decide, how did you glom onto Greta's general strike? Why did you decide this is something we should back and we should get behind?
Yeah, so we had, after our launch, we had done a number of open letters, and, you know, we wrote to the new president and all members of Congress and all the way leading up to the midterm elections. And we were basically, you know, trying to be a leader on the issue. But what happened is right around the time of the midterm elections in 2018, Greta starts her strike, and it's like nobody knows about it. And in December, so here the political realities shift with the House of Representatives going into a much more, in a stance that actually is interested in addressing the issue. And then in December, I remember seeing the talk that Greta gave at the UN climate conference in Poland. And I don't know if your listeners are aware of this, but there is a 3.5-minute video clip of Greta Thunberg in front of the world leaders. And it's jaw-dropping in the clarity, the light bulb went on in that we realized that, okay, we're a grassroots, a nonpartisan grassroots action platform trying to figure things out here. I see her speech, and it's like this paradigm shift where we, the adults who have, you know, this was on our turf. This problem was created with us, the adults in the room, letting it happen. And to see at the time, she was 15 years old, and to see her have the courage to stand in front and face the uncomfortableness of it, the courage that it took, I was just like, it's absolutely clear. We have to take her platform and put it behind her. We can support her, and that's where we sort of switched our focus and we started the Stand With Greta campaign.
Now, how many architects are with you on this? You've got quite a bundle, and they're from across the country. They're signing things. It's not just a Chicago thing.
Yes, it's a national thing. We have about 90 firms right now that have taken a pledge. I think there's about 17 of those are from Chicago, and there's even a handful internationally. But we have asked them to basically, you know, talk to their employees also and encourage them or tell them that if they are interested in joining an issue like that, that they should be, you know, that they should feel free to join.
And it's an interesting
thing. A general strike is something that does not really happen in the U.S. We have some big protests sometimes, but the idea of a general strike and the school strikes have been kind of modest. The protests have been, you know, not as large as the ones in Europe or Australia or some of the other places in the world. And so you almost have to encourage your people to go out and take part in it.
Yes. I think this is a boot camp for the kind of activism that we need. I mean, I'm very curious how many people will show up, how many architects will show up. But this is just – this is the opening act. There will inevitably be more of this next year and leading up to the election. And I see it as a – I mean, the truth is in America, it's the notion, and we've experienced this as we've talked to our friends and colleagues in the industry. We say, are you going to encourage your, you know, are you talking about this with your staff? And it's a very difficult conversation for people.
I'm talking with Thomas Jacobs. He's co-founder of Architects Advocate for Action on Climate Change, and he's a partner at Crick and Sexton Architects. And we're talking about the general strike on September 20th. Architects Advocate for Action on Climate Change is encouraging firms to sign up and take part in the activism. How do you see this with other civil society organizations? Because, you know, usually if there's a general strike in a country, there's, you know, different societies stand up. It's going to be the school teachers. It's going to be the municipal workers. It's going to be other civil society groups stand up for it. And now here we don't seem to have that kind of terrain.
I just think we're not there yet. But we have to figure out a way to get there. And so we also thought as architects, we do see ourselves as leaders, and some of it is inherent in what we do. When, you know, when we plan a building or a community, we have to look out into the future to envision it. And so we deal with it every day. And so maybe it was somewhat natural for us to take this stance. But of course, our hope is that through this action and our involvement, that others might, you know, maybe get the same idea. And I really think this is necessary.
Yeah, I always wonder about who is in on sustainability and who the firms that are sustainable. And I'm a team leader for Bike to Work Week at the station.
Yes.
And I've looked at the rundown of the firms who participate in Bike to Work Week, and there's a billion architect firms who take part. And, you know, I've had the guy from Studio Gang who's the team leader on, and we talked to him. But these really are the people who are concerned about sustainability. And there are some of the institutions that you would expect, the Field Museum, things like that. But there's marketing firms, there's other firms that seem to, you know, I would have no idea were actually want to do things, that want to get involved and want to participate in things that are going to make our planet more sustainable. They're out there, but everybody's got to figure it out.
Yeah, and I think that's the awareness piece, right? I mean, what we're doing is creating awareness, because the conversation doesn't exist to a sufficient level yet. And so, you know, I just, on my way here, I came from IIT where I teach. And so also our focus, or my focus personally, is very much on the next generation also. Because my argument is that, again, we are the adults theoretically in the room. We've had plenty of time. We've known about this issue for decades, and we have somehow allowed for this to go on without taking action. So I think where we need an attitude shift is along – and this is where Greta comes in. I mean, she's sort of this example. I mean, my money is on the young people, in that we are now at a moment in human history where they don't have the same privilege probably you and I had when we graduated and the world was relatively stable, and then we said, okay, and now you go out in the world and test stuff. These days are over. The young people graduating from whether high school or college face a world today where they have to not only learn the trade and make all these experiences, they have to become part of this existential threat. And so I feel for them, and or am trying to do everything I can to be honest with them and say, whether you like it or not, but this is where we're at, but there are things you can do. And so my hope is that actually young people, young architects, start to push against firms and say, what are you doing? What are your policies? And ask questions and get engaged.
And certainly we see the young people with a similar set of urgency to Greta and the same kind of moral persuasion coming up with the Sunrise Movement, and Extinction Rebellion also has that kind of attitude that we must do it now, and we must do things that are pretty drastic.
That's exactly it. The now is so important. I mean, I literally just talked about that this morning. It's like we have to do it now. So I'm giving a lecture at the college in about 2 weeks. We are trying to organize to get the entire College of Architecture to participate. And if we don't know if it's going to work, because it's all, you know, it's trial and error. It's a live experiment. But if we can sufficiently succeed, maybe the School of the Art Institute and UIC College of or School of Architecture, you know, I mean, this has to be a snowball effect, and we'll see how far we can get this year.
You know, in architecture, I always look around and I see a lot of new building taking place, a lot of things going on, and I kind of look at a building and I think this doesn't look really sustainable. It looks like another glass box to me. This looks like another house to me that doesn't have solar panels, isn't using the sun to heat itself. These things would seem so simple, we just don't do them. And I don't know if that I have architect friends who say, actually, those new buildings going up are twice as efficient as whatever they're replacing, and it's not as bad as it looks sometimes. But really, it is it are we doing enough when we're building our cities as codes? There's like codes that come in and, you know, are they tough enough? You know, we're gradually upping the codes, but is that enough? Is the developers, do they not want to do anything because they have to pay for it all? Or I don't know where the equation is where we say, wow, we're doing enough now.
Yeah. You know, what your friends are telling you is absolutely true. Of course, that glass box is twice as good as it was whatever 10 years ago, but it's not good enough. And I want to be very clear. I mean, we as a member of the profession, of the Chicago architecture profession, and also as a member of our firm, we are as much part of that problem as anybody else. In Chicago in particular, and you know the Mies legacy at IIT, for instance, and the glass box in particular, we have a glass box addiction. And we know, given the information we are presented with now, that, you know, things like the ratio between how much glass you have and how much solid wall makes a huge difference. So today we have to, the Chicago architecture community and myself, we all have to, the first step is to acknowledge that we have a problem, and we have to talk about it, and we have to say, what does that mean? What are we telling people in education? And we have to build dramatically higher performing, because the codes are not tightening up fast enough. If we go with the speed of improvement with the codes, it will take approximately another 150 years to get the carbon drawdown to where it needs to be.
Oh.
That's a problem.
That's a problem. I want to give you a chance to say something about September 20th. The general strike will take place. If people want to get more involved, if there's architecture firms who are listening who want to get more involved, if there's other members of civil society, what do they do?
Well, thank you for that prompt. I mean, our main vehicle of the pledge and all on information is on architects-advocate.com, our webpage. There you can find the pledge. You can basically join it, and then you know you're listed on that webpage. On the day of, on the 20th, we are meeting at Federal Plaza at 11:30, and the only requirement, you know, we sort of keep pointing out, this is another thing where you know that in this culture nobody is used to striking, because everybody says, what are we going to do? And we say, what do you mean? It's grassroots. Figure it out. So even that, like, you have to explain everything to everybody. So we say, no, just come. Bring a sign. You're a designer. Make it, you know, make it look amazing. communicate with simple terms, and then we'll learn from that experience and we'll be ready for the next global climate strike, which will happen inevitably soon.
It's a movement. Thomas Jacobs is co-founder of Architects Advocate for Action on Climate Change. He's a partner at Crick and Sexton Architects. Thanks for joining us and talking about the general strike on September 20th.
Thank you, Jerome. It was a pleasure.
Coming up after the break, we'll have Weekend Passport, where we let you know how to have an international good time on the weekend, and we'll tell you about a 6-hour performance theater piece outside. We'll hear about the Camino Project from Theater Y. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. It's time for Weekend Passport, where we let you know how to have an international good time on the weekend. Our global citizen friend Nari Safavi comes in and makes recommendations on how to have fun with an international twist. Great to see you, Nari.
Good day, Jerome. It's great to be here again.
Well, this is Labor Day weekend, and festivals abound on Labor Day weekend, and there's a couple of great ones that pop up every
year. Happy Labor Day weekend to everyone and all the people who labor very, very strenuously to make our economy work and probably don't get appreciated. I want to make sure that they all have a great Labor Day weekend. And there are a lot of really interesting end-of-summer events going on in the city, and of course, Labor Day weekend is something that the African Festival of the Arts in Chicago usually puts together a really great event at Hyde Park, 30th annual Festival of African Arts. It's actually the 30th year. And it starts today at 1 p.m. and it goes on through Monday, actually, September 2nd, 100 South Cottage Grove Avenue, Chicago.
And the musical acts are always fantastic.
Fantastic. Great reggae acts, great West African bands, and all over. Years and years and years, I've heard some of them. Greats of African
great
music.
Great food, great shopping.
Great shopping. Kind of like, exactly. Arts and crafts, stuff for kids to do. So it's getting so big, it's getting hard to describe it. It's just, you just got to go there and experience it.
30th Annual African Festival of the Arts on South Cottage Grove Avenue in Chicago.
Yeah. And there is another thing going on tonight that I think would be worthwhile to check out. Who's Who in Chicago? Who's Who is, of course, has always been a big brand in terms of recognizing people for what they do. And Who's Who Chicago is having an event tonight at 7 p.m. at a place called the City Hall, located at 838 West Kinsey Street. And they're recognizing some of the most prominent Chicagoans involved in community organizing, arts, philanthropy. So there are a lot of really interesting blend of Chicagoans being awarded over there tonight. And the ticket price is not very high. It's very reasonable. It would be worthwhile to go and check it out tonight.
All right. Sounds like fun. Sounds like worthwhile company.
Definitely. But last but not least, our good friends at Theater Y are at it again. They're doing something really interesting and innovative. They have been here before in our program, before in our segment. But the El Camino project that they have been doing by Theater Y, it's basically something that has to deal with the Camino de Santiago, the pilgrimage that people take from southern France into Spain. They did that 2 summers ago, and they turned it into an art project, performance art project, and a documentary film is being made about it. They are reenacting some of that at the High Line here in Chicago, and it's really a friendly thing for the entire family to participate.
Melissa Lorraine is here. She's artistic director at Theater Y. Great to see you, Melissa.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, a couple of years ago when you told us and asked us to come with you on the Camino de Santiago, I was like, wow, you guys are crazy. You're going to walk this 500 miles and then you're going to make a play about it. I was anxious to see how it turned out.
Yeah, we were too.
this was like ambition beyond ambition.
It's very true. And we were all nervous. I mean, our work is usually on a limb, but this is way further out on the limb. As you say, we walked it 2 summers ago. We invited Chicago to walk with us, and we had a couple WBEZ listeners who joined our pilgrimage as a result of this show.
Yeah.
And then trying to figure out how you turn that into a theatrical production was quite something. How do you pretend to offer an experience like pilgrimage in a brief, concise way? And sure enough, it was clear that you couldn't talk about walking without walking. So we decided that the show needed to be an ambulatory performance. Originally, it was a 12-hour show, so you're welcome. We cut it down to 6, and now it's 6 hours. It's 5 miles. Josh Flanders from the Chicago Reader says it's worth your time and effort. We are reader recommended, Picture This Post recommended. We were listed as one of the top 5 shows in New City to see this month. They're calling it a theatrical experience unlike any other, a dream come true. Crazy statements are coming out of the audience, and we're the most surprised by the way they're responding, honestly.
Now, explain how you lay something like this out, because you're starting at like the 606, and you're walking the 606 and around, and then you're coming back to where you started. And
that's right.
And along the way, people meet theater thing.
That's right.
Yeah.
choosing the course was one of the first and hardest tasks. What is this route that we do? And it was a combination of an offering of Humboldt Park from the Chicago Park District, and then trying to figure out how we could also end with a meal. So we needed a host for the meal, and that's turned out to be the Bloomingdale Arts Building. So those two factors kind of stapled in early, and then I figured out, okay, how do we take the audience on an experience? And some have called it Dadaism, surrealism.
It is not a linear story.
It is not a linear story.
Melissa goes walking and
that's
then
correct.
Melissa sees.
That's correct. It's really important to us that the audience is given time and space to have their own experience, to make their own experience, much like the Camino is not a roller coaster. It's a pilgrimage. So something of the experience has to remain internal, and we're just proposing things constantly to stir the imagination. So it is remarkable the way the city participates in the show, the way that I have fallen in love again with the city through the course of performing this show, because it turns out if you trust the people, they become trustworthy. And so the people around us are adding to the experience and sometimes joining in halfway through and walking the rest of the way with us, eating the meal with us, spontaneously joining.
You don't bust them for not having a ticket?
Well, technically we should, but we just can't bring ourselves to do this. It's about hospitality, you know. We were hoping that by stealing these two components from the Camino, the walking component and then the kind of precarity that comes with that, the fact that everyone is exposed in some way, it breeds hospitality. It breeds a unique kind of sympathy and warmth among people. And so then to say, I'm sorry, there's no room at the inn feels really counterintuitive. So we've let a few people sneak in.
Well, Santiago would never turn anybody
That's
away.
Right.
But I understand that you even like go and issue people a passport from the
That's
Bureau
right.
of Transit
right.
Affairs.
Well,
so there is a way that you initially engage people, and there is, yeah. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, we knew we were out of our depth, you know. We're used to offering an experience within four walls. And so to help us move this many people through the city, we invented a Bureau of Transient Affairs that give you your credentials and that give you a sense that you are exactly where you should be from moment to moment when you're feeling like maybe this is going off script, which of course it always is in some way because
right.
the city is so involved. But it's been another way to really put the burden on the attendee to have the experience that they want to have, that it's less about presenting them with something, it's less about consumerism, and it's more about engaging in time and space for yourself with agency. And we're just a service that's facilitating your travels.
Now, at one point during the experience, people have the option of being blindfolded and led around or not?
That's correct. We were trying to keep that under wraps, but the Chicago Reader... No, you're fine. The Chicago Reader was the first to do that. So it's true. It's true that we give that option. And we were expecting very few people to take us up on it. And it turns out that almost everybody opts for being blindfolded, which is a tall order to lead a whole crowd blind through the park.
Well, that's got to be quite a sight.
It is. It really is.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a shock that adults, when given the right circumstances, are so ready to play. It's delightful.
So what are some of the feedbacks? Do you engage people after they're done with it? Have you gotten any feedback you can share with us?
We have a meal together in a very casual, non-theatrical way. And so usually theater-wide productions have a talk-back session, but we felt like after 6 hours, if we haven't talked together enough, then we've done something wrong. So the meal stands in as a kind of talk-back. And the most remarkable thing, I mean, I'll be honest, the goal was always camaraderie and community. But to suppose that people would actually consider these strangers friends of theirs by the end of the 6 hours felt like an overstatement, and or idealistic at the very least. And Josh Flanders from The Reader was the first to say that he felt like he had made a whole group of friends by the end of the day, which is astonishing. I mean, what else can you hope to achieve through the arts? And it's interesting how the arts can fill in a space that we usually look to politics to accomplish. Right. And in fact, politics has limits in terms of what it can actually foster between people. And this experiment, this social experiment, is really renewing my faith in Chicago and in Chicagoans, to be totally honest. I'm the most shocked by the way that people are rising to this occasion.
Oh, I think 6 hours of stimulating experience ought to be sufficient for a lot of people to at least bond at some level with people who are who are going through the journey with you.
Yeah. And the show filters out its own naysayers. You know, people who don't want a 6 hour experience aren't there to begin with. So you've already gathered together a group of people with time that they want to invest. It's free. So that's a
theater
huge...
Theater Y is a free theater
that's
company.
That's right. Yeah. We are a free theater company. So this is 6 hours of a 5 mile trek, theatrical experiences, dance, movement, performance art, snacks, and a full meal for nothing, you know? Yeah.
Well, there you go. Now, Nari and I want to do this. You're doing this through September 22nd on Saturdays and Sundays.
That's right. And we are working with the Park District to extend to October 13th because it is proving to be very popular. So I know that we will need to extend. So if you're interested and you can't make it before the 22nd, just check back on our website in a week or so to see whether we've got more tickets to the 13th of October.
I can't carve out time this weekend. It's 6 hours. But I'm going to get it soon.
No, this is something that you have to basically
it's from three to nine.
That's
three
right.
Nine.
Exactly.
So it's a big swath of time.
It is
a big swath of time.
But we've been told it flies by.
How about the young people? Are they part of this or...
We have a 6-month-old in the show, but
okay.
But children, I mean, I don't know. There's nothing inappropriate about the show. It's a trek. So I guess that would be the biggest thing about whether or not to invite children. Are they capable of a 5 mile trek without becoming weary? But we do have a wheelchair on hand for anybody who suddenly feels they can't manage the walk anymore, or if they would like. To be in the wheelchair from the start, that's also an
You've option. Planned a lot of contingencies, haven't you?
What's the craziest public thing that's happened so far, like with the interaction with the universe?
Okay, well, it is Humble Park. So we had a gang of like four-wheelers and motorcycles who descended upon the show in one moment, because anybody can show up at any time. And they happened to be in a place where we were going to dance in just a few moments. So I asked them if they would kindly leave for just a few moments while we danced. And then they got wind of where the audience would be. And they drove their four-wheelers and motorcycles around the lake and joined the audience suddenly, like from all sides, if you can imagine this.
Enjoyed the dance.
And started participating in the show. They've actually made a second appearance. They've come back to a second performance at another time.
Amazing. Bike speakers join the thing.
Yeah.
The Camino Project by Theater Y, going through October probably. Check it out. You can sign up and RSVP. It is free theater at theater-y.com. Do I got that right, Melissa? Melissa Lorraine is artistic director at Theater Y. Thanks a lot. Have a great weekend with your people out there. And Nari Safavi, have a great weekend yourself. Thanks for joining us for Weekend Passport.
Happy Labor Day weekend, everyone.
I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.